New York City?
I was in New York City last week. And
what were you doing in New York City?
We were Dan and I were looking to the very first steps towards opening a New York office for Unbound. So very exciting.
Wow.
We saw good people.
Well, you're funny you should mention that. So it also coincided with the Book Expo, which is in a massive place called the Javits Center, which is on the Hudson River. It's the biggest venue I've ever seen for a book event. And in fact, that was rather nice. It was the only time I've been to a book trade event where there was a lot of space between the stands. You know, you could breathe, or you could hide and not talk to people. But I had one moment which I thought I should share. I mean, amongst the many great, we had an afternoon at Kickstarter, and we had hung out with Morgan Entrecon and great people, publishing people. But the cool moment was going to the New York Review of Books Classics stand, and Sarah Kramer coming up to me and saying, "It's my favourite podcast in all the world. Can I just say thank you? And if you want any of these books..." And I said, obviously I was a bit flattered, a bit embarrassed, to be honest, being English, but very pleased. And it's anyway, it's very sweet. So
that's amazing.
It was just quite... it was a bit surreal standing in the middle of a Javits Center surrounded by... I mean, I'd just seen James Patterson doing a signing. So to wander up and then to be recognised for... "I just couldn't read..." She said, "I was just reading your badge. I couldn't believe it was you." Yes, it is. In all my ice cream sundae glory.
Well,
so that was very successful and exciting. So we'll be going back for sure. But great. It's just such a great city. And I have to say, reading Zivon's book...
We should definitely extend our world tour of backlisted live venues to somewhere in New York. I mean, it seems foolish not to.
Very foolish. Very foolish. Live in NYC. Yes, that was great. And then I was back to Hay. I went to Hay one weekend, went to New York, came back to Hay. And you've been, meanwhile, in Stoke.
I was at North London's most popular literary festival, the Stoke Newington Literary Festival last weekend, as was our guest, Richard. You were there, weren't you?
Yes, happy time.
You had a packed house, because I was there and I saw that packed house.
Yeah, we were talking about politics and whether it's stranger than fiction, so the material was ample.
Yeah, it was a really interesting session. And I went to see Stuart Evers and Maggie G do a session about protest that our former guest Kit Duvall was supposed to be attending as well and couldn't get there because of the disruption after
the London Bridge events. Page, book on protest.
That's right, yeah.
I saw an event, a really good event in Hay on that very theme with...
Yeah, this was really good.
...with Frank Cottrell Boyce and Courtney Newland, which was very good.
I did a session of this thing I've done at Stoke Newington before called Author Confidential, where I had a really nice panel of authors together and I asked them to talk about what it's like to be an author at the sharp end. And I have to say, the thing that resonated most with the audience was I was talking about how I don't really understand the thing. I mean, I really love Twitter, as you will realise, and I'm on it a lot, and I find it very funny. But I also find it infuriating at times. And I was saying to the audience, the thing I hate on Twitter more than anything else is where if you say, you know, I tell you what I really like. You know, I really like Cat Stevens. And I guarantee someone will go, "Cat Stevens is shit, mate." Yeah. Right? And I was talking about the worst time this ever happened to me, and the thing that was a line in the sand. I was at a hotel on the Isle of Man, and I was feeling quite homesick, and I came down for breakfast. It was a nice full English breakfast, full Douglas breakfast. And with my breakfast, some fried bread came. And so I ate some fried bread. I thought, this is nice. I haven't had fried bread like this since I was a kid. And so, full of happiness and homesickness, I tweeted. It's not great content, I give you. But I tweeted, "Oh, I'm eating some fried bread and it's really nice." And three people went, "Oh, fried bread's shit, mate." Right? People can't help themselves. It's so... I try never to do that. If you don't like something, Matt, I think it's often better to just keep quiet about it, don't you?
Do you?
Speaking of which, we should start, really. Do you see that tweet that's going around with the picture from Zulu? Have you seen that? Hot takes, sir. Thousands of them. Okay.
Shall we start? Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast which gives new life to old books. My name's John Richardson and I publish books at Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to create something special.
And I'm Andy Miller, and I write books, including a book about the kinks of the Village Green Preservation Society, which I mention today, because in keeping with our already theme of me having a bee in my bonnet about things people do on Twitter, I saw somebody this week describe the kinks of the Village Green Preservation Society as, quote, well Brexit. And if I see anyone else do that, I will explain the kinks of the Village Green Preservation Society to them until they are dead. Happily, right? So that's me. John.
Well, man, you join us in a seven-story suite in the Riot House on Sunset Boulevard, where Andy has just chucked the TV off the balcony into the swimming pool. Because today we're discussing, apologies to our American listeners, we're discussing I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon, edited by Crystal Zevon.
And this is, we're talking about that book, but we're also talking about other books this time, because this is an oral histories or an oral biographies special edition of Backlisted. We felt confident that probably no other podcast would have an oral history special edition, but here we are to do it. So we're talking about I'll Sleep When I'm Dead by Crystal Zevon. We're also going to be talking about a few other oral histories or oral biographies. And with us today to talk about that subject, this book in particular, and oral histories in general, is the author and editor Richard T. Kelly. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
He's a bluff man, as you'll discover.
That's a listeners.
Speakers
are fine. Course, play, display.
I edit other people's words, he says, but rarely use my own. Richard's novels include Crusaders, The Possessions of Dr. Forrest, and The Knives. And he has also written and edited a couple of oral histories, stroke oral biographies himself on Alan Clark, the film director Alan Clark, who directed Scum and Pender's Fen and
Made in Britain and
Rita Sue and Bob Too. And also biography of Sean Penn. Is that an oral history?
It is.
So we're going to be talking a little bit to Richard about how you go about putting one of these books together. But we should also say, in a sense, Richard is the ultimate Backlisted guest, because he used to run Faber Finds. Faber Finds is the part of Faber devoted to finding...
Giving new life to old books.
Giving new life to old books, exactly right. Yeah. And so several of the books that we've covered here on Backlisted have been available for us to read, thanks to Richard's efforts at Faber Finds.
Bridget Brophy was one that
sprang. Yeah, the Snowball and the amazing Emmerich Pressburger.
Yeah.
Ah, novel. Glad you like that. Yeah.
That's a wonderful book. How did that come to be?
Well, I have the good fortune of
Glass Pearls. That's called, isn't it?
Yes, Glass Pearls. Mr. Pressburger's grandson, Kevin MacDonald, the Oscar-winning film director, is a pal of mine, and he, having liked what Faber Finds was up to, sent the book my way. I mean, I think, to be honest, he was hoping just something could be done with it, because Pressburger wrote two novels, both of which had fallen into the cracks.
Yeah,
as it
yeah.
were. But this one was obviously great, and I said, oh, I'd love to do this in Faber Finds, if you don't mind.
So that's what we're doing today, and normally we would
do what we've been
reading this week, but we thought it would be better if we both talked about, before we got onto the Zevon book, that we talked a little bit about some of our favourite oral histories or writers who've put those books together. So, John, what oral histories have you been reading over the last 30 years?
Well, the one that I think everybody comes back to. I mean, we could talk. I'm a huge fan of Studs Terkel, amazing impresario and journalist. And his book on the Great War was a classic. I mean, he kind of initiated the genre,
genre. I've got a list of them here. The Good War.
Yeah, Good War.
Oral History of World War II, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Yeah.
I think it started as an academic discipline, didn't it, really, Richard? People going out and collecting, sort of talking to...
Yeah, you think about... Talk,
preserving kind of the people who were going to die, and as a way of getting the history of ordinary people.
Yeah, and if you think about what mass observation were up to in Britain after the war, and during the war, the academic sociological interest was very obvious.
But you get the authenticity of the voice, and then I guess the thing that makes them interesting is that they're almost like they're kind of plotted as dramas. So you can tell.
We should say, if anybody doesn't know, an oral history is
it's not the nicest edited, term, is
an
it?
An edited collection of interview material where the protagonists tell their own story.
Mostly in their own words. And the one that I go back to, and I think a lot of people go back to as a sort of classic of the genre, is Edie. By Jean Stein, which is the life of Edie Sedgwick.
Edie, an American biography.
An American biography, and it is it's much more than just somebody's life. I mean, it's the history of her family. It's the history of it's the book. I think Mailer called it the book about the 60s that we always wanted somebody to write. It's a massive. I mean, if ever there was a kind of that sort of idea of something that is properly symphonic, you know, with all these different kind of ranges, and you know, you've got Truman Capote, you've got on one side, you've got family members, you've got Warhol, you've got Patti Smith, you've got people who knew her members of her family, you've got people who were historians of the period. It is a page turner, because the story is, and this is an interesting thing which you often find in oral histories, they become emblematic. I mean, it's almost like a sort of a Greek tragedy, the way, with the chorus and the voices off. And the one voice that kind of isn't there, in a way, is hers. It's a sort of a...
I remember I bought a copy of Edie from must be mid-80s, from, I want to say, Claude Gill. If you remember Claude Gill?
Yeah, I do.
In Charing Cross Road, because I was just discovering the Velvet Underground. So I had Victor Bocris's Oral History of the Velvet Underground uptight, and here was this book about Edie Sedgwick, so I bought it. I must have read Edie about 4 or 5 times in the space of a couple of years. It's so...
It's totally compelling, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I just was rereading it again at the weekend, and what I find is every time I go back, I found that the early stuff about the family, which I sort of skipped over to get to the Warhol bits... Reading it sort of 20 years later, I'm much more interested in that. You think that what... So Jean Stein herself was she did a number of these. She did a sort of similar biography of Robert Kennedy.
And we should probably cite that, did them with George Plimpton, who was her editor at Paris.
So she started as an editor. She's also, I discovered, as you do, grazing Wikipedia, that she worked as Ilya Kazan's assistant when he was making... Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah.
So she's, interesting woman. And the most, that sort of Plimpton generation, Paris Review.
They publish American Journey, which is the book about Robert Kennedy, in 1970, and then they publish Edie in 1982. And Edie becomes a bestseller.
Yeah.
I think probably to everybody's surprise.
And sort of in a funny kind of way, as if I remember it correctly at the time, it's sort of, for a whole generation of us, it reinvested the whole Warhol myth in the 60s and the Velvets. I think a lot of people that had maybe kind of dipped as the 70s went on and punk erupted, by early 80s, suddenly this book came out, and it was the book that all, Bowie fans, everybody who... I don't know, was it on his list? I bet it was, wasn't it? It must have been on his list.
And she, anyway, so, and also last year she published a book called West of Eden, which is about the six founding families of Hollywood, which our guest on the last episode, Niven Govinda, was raving to me about when I mentioned that we were going to be doing this. So she's published these 2 or 3 big books, which sort of... I've got a definition here. There's a really good article, which we tweeted a link to, by Gillian McCain and Legs McNeil, author of the brilliant Oral History of US Punk, Please Kill Me.
Which is another classic of the
indeed.
Genre.
And they quote Jean Stein's definition here of what she and Plimpton were trying to do. She used the term oral narrative, which also isn't great, is it? But she used
oral's the problematic word.
Oral narrative. Oral history has been largely thought of as the collecting of interview transcripts for storage in archives in order to provide historians with research material. Somewhat less common is the use of interview transcripts as a literary form, in which the raw transcripts are edited, arranged, and allowed to stand for themselves without the intervention by the historian. So that's what we're talking about. And we should ask Richard, which is the most fun bit of putting together an oral narrative? Is it the interviewing, the accumulating, the editing, or the having finished?
Well, the worst part is the transcribing, by a million miles, but every writer knows that.
Yeah.
The interviewing, all being well, is great fun. Sometimes it's torture. But you if you do one of these, you're committed you have to talk to everybody. So you can't pick and choose. You just got to... the subject, family, friends, people they loved, people they hated, the concentric circles just keep going. around. So you have some fun there, and some it's a bit trickier. The satisfying part of it, the part that feels like writing, is the crafting of it. To me, the heart of the matter, why the form becomes so good at the point when it becomes good with Plimpton and Jean Steen, is its relation to the American genius of the new journalism in that period, okay, the era of Wolfe and Mailer and Gay Talese, and applying fictional qualities to non-fictional projects. I mean, I was looking the other day at Tom Wolfe's original manifesto of the new journalism, where he obviously in his not backward coming forward way tried to show what new journalism should do, and I think it bears very close relation to what oral history should do, what its strength should be. The dramatic quality of scenes upon scenes, where the backstory isn't really there, but it has to have forward momentum. You need dialogue, the spoken word in a dynamic form, and you need something interesting going on with point of view. And the great thing about oral history is its form allows you to say, I don't know what the truth is. I can put together two contradictory versions on the page together, and you go and decide.
And when you were looking for models, I mean, one of the things that seems that the good ones do is that they have that sort of vernacular intimacy, but it's, they're not, obviously, all the pauses and the ums and the ahs and the repetitions are taken out. When you were looking at your subjects, did you have models is it more a question of finding the right tone for the subject?
Oh, I mean, you certainly want to make everyone speak, and you want to be a sort of dramatist that way, so the voices rub against each other. Yeah. It's a bit like being a writing plays or screenplays, or in novels too. Each character has to have their own voice. To differentiate them, they should become recognisable to the reader that way. So you have to have some kind of ear for speech patterns. Obviously, you're getting rid of all those ums and ahs and verbatim transcript nonsense, but you're presenting a plausible version.
Well, it's interesting you say that. For me, one of the things that I really love about these books is that Rashomon element of getting the same story from different points of view. And in fact, John, we should also say that you published probably the best-selling oral history, oral narrative of the last, 20, 30 years,
right? The most expensive best-selling. Which was the Beatles anthology.
Well, the Beatles anthology really makes a virtue of that Rashomon thing, which is because they can't remember and disagree. Make a virtue of constantly saying,
I mean, this is an interesting thing, because, I mean, Richard's done two of people who are still alive. Edie was dead when...
Yeah, well, Alan Clark was dead.
Was he?
Much gathered in memoriam. But Sean Penn was very much alive and is a participant in the books.
Sure, as is, bizarrely, John Lennon in the Beatles anthology. It was a brilliant bit of work. They took largely Rolling Stone interviews and some of the interviews that weren't as familiar, and it was edited into the text. But the rest of it was definitely interviews, long interviews with the three surviving Beatles.
Yeah.
So the thing about it was the first thing is the theatre of the whole thing was amazing. It was Frankfurt Book Fair, and you had to sign an NDA, and you had to go into a room, and you were left with it precisely half an hour to go through. And it was incredibly moving, because it was
It's a great. We should say it's a great book.
And I have no. A great I have book. Nothing to say about the content, because the content was, could add or subtract nothing from it. You were basically given the chance to look at it, and then you had to come back and respond and say how you might want to publish it. Which, amazingly, given that everybody was looking at it at the time, we won the auction. The amazing thing about that book is very, very familiar people seen in an unfamiliar light, and there are stories in there the idea that they'd book out a whole floor of the hotel for them, and the four of them would all end up in one or other of their bathrooms, just sort of hanging out. They're just four working class boys from Liverpool, not really wanting a whole hotel suite. There were just lots of lovely. It's the detail, and I think that's the thing about the form, is that people's memories and what people choose to say about somebody.
That book captures better than any other book the niggly relationship between Paul McCartney and George Harrison.
Yeah.
Right. And there are several times where George Harrison very dryly will say, Paul's always been a year and a half older than me.
Yeah.
Right. Or there's a brilliant bit where they're talking about Dylan, and they say about, with Dylan, who will come up when we talk about Zeeman as well, they say about Dylan, McCartney says, you know, yeah, we met Dylan, he was our idol, you know. And George says, well, he wasn't our idol. You know, we liked him. You know, they're just
and
that
and
kind
that, of... that thing of Paul doing the... And, you know, people don't realise, I was the one that introduced them all to avant-garde art. It wasn't John, it was me. I was the one who... And, you know, it's... Well, I think I told you the story, which is my favourite story. The thing of the book was working with Neil Aspinall was one of the great experiences.
Who had been the Beatles roadie was the head of Apple.
Head of Apple, amazing. I mean, he was, you know... Again, he'd grown up on the streets, as it were, with them. And the only person who'd been through... And who told me very early, he said, there's no point asking me, John, about my book. It'll never see the light of day. I've promised him. And he said, that's a promise I'll keep till the day. He's dead now, sadly. But he was like Yoda. It was like, so he was full of these kind of, you know, if you can see the bandwagon, you've already missed it, you know, that kind of stuff. And when we did a marketing plan, he threw it in the bin. It's brilliant. Looked at it 10 minutes, threw it in the bin. I said, Neil, what are you doing? He said, we're the Beatles. He said, we always go to number one. He said, we don't... But then later on, I learned a huge amount. Sitting at the... When we won the Nibby for Illustrated Book of the Year, sitting at the table, and I said, can you explain to me Paul's poetry book, which published by Faber? And he said, well, what do you want me to explain? I said, well, there's a few, you know, perfectly nice poems at the front, and then the rest are Beatles lyrics. And he said, yes. He said, well, and your question. I said, well, you know, we all know the Beatles lyrics. We don't particularly need them gathered into it to trick out a book of poetry. And he said, well, why do you think Paul would want to do that? And I said, I have no idea. He said, well, who wrote the Beatles songs? And I said, well, Lennon and McCartney. Oh, shit. You mean, welcome to my world, John. Welcome to my world. It's just priceless, but there you go. Yeah, just letting everybody know, these were mine.
So going back to, is it Gene Stein or Steen? Gene. I've been saying it wrong all these years.
I couldn't tell you myself.
I'm going to stick to Gene Stein.
Yeah.
Well, so Gene Stein died about a month ago.
Yeah.
At the age of 83. So Edie, going back to Edie, the thing about Edie, which I think is significant, as you were saying, John, is there's sort of, it helps create that 80s interest in the Velvet Underground and in the Factory and all those things. But I also think because it was a bestseller and because it talked about some pop subjects, but some historically interesting subjects in that way. It was a very influential book on how people came to write about film and popular music and other popular forms. The oral history form almost often takes the standard.
I mean, when we did a book on punk that wasn't Legs McNeil, but the Legs McNeil book had come out shortly before we did a big illustrated book on punk, we did the same thing, went and interviewed lots of people. We did a book here that we funded on 80s club culture. I mean, I think it becomes almost like the standard. If you want to take a bit of cultural history and to make it kind of authentic, you go and talk to the people who
were
there.
We should mention a couple of books. We should definitely mention Days in the Life by our former guest, Jonathan Green, which is a magnificent book about 1960s London and the counterculture. And we should also mention Daniel Rachel's book that came out last year, Walls Come Tumbling Down, which has just won the Penderyn Music Prize. Which I've got, I haven't read, but I have a copy of, which I've been trying not to read, to be honest with you, because I know that I'll get sucked into it straight away, which is a book about rock against racism and about political pop in the 80s. It seems like, as we were saying earlier, it's a really good form to capture people who can talk and have something to say.
Yeah. I mean, the subject matter, the personality at the heart of it has to be a lively individual. You know, they have to inspire storytelling. Where everybody you meet will go, yeah, I've got some stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to put a word in for the one that inspired me to do mine, which is Mailer, His Life and Times by Peter Manso. Vast, door-stopping thing. But a great American life and a great American artist, and the thing is masked in precisely the way we've been talking about.
One of the things I was thinking about is what I love about the form is you don't get the... you know, kind of idle psychologizing that a lot of biographers, which seems to me to be, I think what...
Or do you?
Right, here's what you get. I mean, these books are authored, you know, and this is the other new journalism trick.
So they look like they're history, yeah, but in fact they're prosecuting an agenda.
Yeah, you arrange the pieces. I mean, the way I do the books is I skeletally map them out, and then I attach the quotes to serve the structure. But I'm not alone.
No, of course, it's not some kind of neutral practice.
It's
the thing that Gillian McCain, Legs McNeil refer to it. There's a brilliant. Again, I commend this to everyone listening. There's six. They give you six rules of putting one of these books together, and I think the second or third one is it's not writing, it's carving.
Yes.
You know, which might be why we all like them, because there is an editorial element to it. It's
closer to documentary filmmaking than most forms of writing. Your rushes are your material, and so you're stuck with that. But like the piece of marble determines the sculpture.
It's a really good point, but when we come on to the Zevon later, I watched the VH1 documentary that was made.
Same here.
And you realise what a thin gruel most documentary filmmaking is in comparison to the book.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you just get so much more detail and so a much more complex...
Andy's
got another brilliant.
My favourite. Your choice, I know Andy. This is my favourite oral history, but it's one of my favourite books, bar none. Is a book that was published. I'm just going to show this to the gentleman at the other side of the table.
I was very, very bad.
There's a picture of Jimmy Savile saying I was very, very bad, and this was published in 1994 or 5, 6. So this is a book called The Wrestling, by Simon Garfield. Simon Garfield, who's gone on to write all sorts of interesting and wonderful books.
Maps, Time, his new book, yeah, Out on Time.
And this is a book about British wrestling from the early 70s that I used to watch with
Mick
my
McManus,
dad. Mick McManus.
Jackie Palo.
Big Daddy, Giant Haystacks, Adrian Street, and on the front cover of this book, Kendo Nagasaki. I guarantee you can open this book at any page and some superb anecdote spills out, right? And I thought, I will just read you two very tiny things. Then actually, Simon Garfield puts himself in as a character in this book and gives himself the first words. So chapter one, that fat bastard, I could kill him, said Jackie Palo, is the name of that chapter, right? Simon Garfield. In August 1995, more than 150 professional wrestlers gathered at a pub in Greenwich to talk about how things used to be, a reunion. They looked all right, apart from the ears. But their walking was terrible. And when they got up to order a drink, you saw that many had bad limps or ruined backs. It was like a reunion of people with hip replacements. A friend of mine took a group photograph. We positioned some of them outside the pub in several rows, with some kneeling at the front, and Mick McManus looking like the team captain. And when we finished, a couple of them had to be hoisted to their feet because their knee joints had shattered. It was Wayne Bridges' pub. Wayne's other name was Bill. People had come down from Scotland to attend, and it turned into the biggest single gathering of wrestlers there had ever been. I was told that whenever wrestlers get together, they just sit around and lie to each other. But it wasn't all like that, right? So that straight away, right? That's so good, right? Now I interviewed Simon about this book. It's still in print. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's so funny, this book, and so touching in terms of these guys who were so famous in Britain in the 60s and 70s, and then vanished into nothing.
World of Sport, 4 o'clock.
Yeah. And my dad and I used to watch the wrestling. The fact that it's even called The Wrestling. Because everyone used to say, you're going to watch The Wrestling. It's not wrestling. You're going to watch The Wrestling, right? And then I interviewed Simon about... I was supposed to be an interview about his favourite books, but it ended up being an interview about my favourite book. I just grilled him for 20 minutes. But going into what we were talking about, because I was so interested about how he had got certain interviewees to say certain things at certain points, or was it all an editorial sleight of hand? And the answer is... like, is wrestling fixed? Yes, it's fixed, but it also hurts. Yeah. You know, it's real, but it's not real, right? It's same like any book. You know, it's a simulacrum of something real, which is totally artificial. So here is Simon.
Like all of art.
Yeah, well, here is the beautiful lie. Here is Simon. Here is Simon saying, looking back a few years later about the writing of the book, and Richard, I think this will probably... chime with you. He says, I had a terrific time writing the wrestling. I attended a wrestler's reunion and visited many wrestlers, old and new, in their homes. The good news was many of them still hated each other. Being both great athletes and actors, they have many fine stories to tell. For a while, I had visions for an exciting ending for the book, one which would involve me climbing into the ring and going a few browsing rounds with a pro. I worked out a bit at the local gym where I had some difficulty with the forward roll. I practiced saying, not the ears, and ask him, ref, but no one seemed overly impressed. I asked Jackie Palo what I would need to become a good fighter, and he said, a complete change of DNA. So I chickened out, fearing that I would have ended up in a hospital, if not dead. The book closes instead with a nice quote from the painter Peter Blake. Peter Blake, who is part of a famous arena documentary about Kendo Nagasaki, who concluded that we have lost something singularly British, but perhaps we shouldn't regret its passing. It had its day, and it was wonderful.
Oh, that's good.
And so that book is still for me, that's still, I think, my favourite, because I love it when you read a book, and it can be in any genre, when you get the feeling from the writer, which you got from the little bit I just read by Simon there, that they know they've got something good. That the trick is to famously carry the valuable vase across the room without dropping it. And Simon Garfield followed this book, The Wrestling, up with a book called The Nation's Favourite, which is an oral history of Radio One. And as coincidentally, we were talking about this just a little bit earlier, and we realised that our producer, Matt Hall, was at Radio 1, or had just left Radio 1 when that book came out, right? Because that book was very, I don't know, popular, but everyone, I mean, it was widely read, wasn't it, at the time?
Yeah, well, it just came out at the exact time that a man called Matthew Bannister had taken over, and it was there was also a documentary called Blood on the Carpet. At the same time, but it was, yeah, it was definitely a quite a kind of big thing around the whole discussion about Radio 1 and the BBC, and there were a lot of kind of discussions around the whole corporation at that time, but it was focused quite a lot on Radio 1 because they'd got rid of, interestingly enough, I was just trying to think, that picture of Jimmy Savile, I presume that Jimmy Savile was also in The Nation's Favourite as well.
Yeah, he's in both.
So yeah,
he's in both. So proceed with care.
Yes, precisely.
But what did people? Do you know what people at Radio 1 thought of the book when it came out?
Certainly, I and I think probably quite a lot of people at Radio 1. I was quite kind of used to kind of getting albums where your name was in the kind of thank you credits and whatever. So I do distinctly remember getting hold of a copy of the Nation's Favourite. Having read the reviews and seen, you know, and knowing the time that it was, the period that it was talking about, and going to the index and issuing a silent thanks to the Lord when I realised that my name wasn't in the index. That there was going to be no mention of me in this book.
My favourite story of all the many brilliant stories in The Nation's Favourite is the story that John Peel told to Simon Garfield. I think it's the first time that he told it on the record, about going... I'm laughing as I say, about going to DLT's house, going to a party at DLT's house and arriving and looking around and saying, Dave, where are all the records? And Dave saying, no, I don't have any records. No, no, dust, the dust, John, the dust. I have cassettes. I listen to those in the car. That's emblematic of Radio 1 being, you know, in the hands, arguably, of people who didn't necessarily... love music, but love being DJs, which was what that book is about, the transition from those people to the next.
Yeah, it's that weird thing that Tony Blackburn, who genuinely does know and love music, sort of morphs into kind of DLT and Simon Bates. And it's another one. I was aware of it. I've never read it. It's kind of...
It's fantastic. It really is.
It is a great book.
Right, this is the exciting moment in the podcast where I get to introduce our sponsor, Unbound, and for this particular episode we've got a plug coming all the way from Topanga in California, from Sophie Kipner and her really, really, really good first novel called The Optimist. Over to you, Sophie.
My name is Sophie Kipner, and I wrote a novel called The Optimist. And it all started I was nannying my friend's little kid at the time and taking her to these gym classes. And I just remember sitting there and not knowing what kind of story I would write or anything. And so I was sitting in this gym class watching my friend's kid, and the teacher was just so ridiculous. He was this inflexible, sort of stoned and out of it, crazy teacher who reminded me of like a Zach Galifianakis character in a movie. And I just thought it was so funny because he was just so ill-equipped to look after these children and obviously didn't want to be there and had no control of the room whatsoever. And yet all these women beside me who were watching him with their kids just thought it was so cute, you know, because here he is, this inflexible gym teacher being sweet with their kids. And all of a sudden they were all, you know, googly-eyed and gushy and thought that he was just the most adorable thing ever. And then I just started imagining this crazy character who would misread his body language and think that she's having some affair with him and then follow him around the room and into the bathroom and thinking that they're having this whole relationship that obviously they're not. But I just sort of went wild with this first story. And then I workshopped it and people wanted to know more about her because she was such a crazy character. And she was so much fun for me to write. It was basically sort of what I knew, and then I just exaggerated the hell out of it. And then I just started writing more and more stories based on that same protagonist. It's called The Gymnast, was that first story, and that was published in a little literary journal for humor in the States. And then I moved to England and continued writing, and all these stories came out with the same character, and then I just developed it into a novel. So that's how it happened. Harrison Ford called me once and said, "Make a reservation for two and put it under the name Jonesy." I didn't understand the occasion, but when Harry wanted to do something, I'd learned not to ask questions. I said, "No problem. See you soon." In room 24, I sat for an hour in a dark suite, directly in the path of one strong beam of sunlight that forced its way through a hole in the curtains. When Harry came in, instead of noticing the way my milky flesh tones and flashes of strawberry blonde hair weaved in and out of the single strand of natural light, the way my green eyes shone as if a light bulb were behind them, he asked me who I was and, "Why are you sitting there?" I told him I thought it would be sexy, unusual, charming. He told me to put my clothes back on. "What do you think this is?" he said. "A farm?" Flushed and confused, I hastily threw my blouse over my corset and returned to the front desk from where I had come. The phone rang again. "Good afternoon," I said. "Hotel Bel Air, how may I help you?" I lost that job shortly after I got it, but I don't allow myself to sit in regret. What a waste of time that would be. I could spend my life thinking that if I had only shaved my legs or worn a kimono instead of that crazy expensive lingerie, maybe things would have worked out differently. But what good would that do? Harry and I just weren't meant to be in love. And that's okay because I have faith in my ability to bounce back. I was in my early 20s. We all make mistakes when we're young. But I was resilient. Things break, and then they heal. Although I guess that's not always true, because one time I broke my elbow in a trapeze accident and I haven't been able to chaturanga ever since. Anyway, Harry was just one story. There have been many.
The Optimist by Sophie Kipner is available from all good bookshops or from the Unbound website at www.unbound.com. Backlisted listeners can get 15% off the listed price by using the special code BACKOFF, that's BACKOFF, no spaces, at the checkout on the Unbound site.
Now, here are our sponsors telling you what to do.
Now that's safely out of the way. I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to plough on with the main meat of
something
the podcast.
Darker from Topanga.
Something darker, but as you say, California very much top of the mind. The California sound of the 1970s, and Warren Zevon.
So first of all, before I ask Richard the traditional question, I'm just going to say if listeners don't know who Warren Zevon is, which it's a very good chance they might not. Warren Zevon is the kind of sort of connoisseur's literary 70s musician.
Yeah.
Right. He never has a big hit with the exception of Werewolves of London, which is entirely unrepresentative of what he was good at.
A joke song that they wrote in 5 minutes and didn't take very seriously.
And so I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. Before I ask you about it, Rich, we're just going to hear something from the author of I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, who is Warren Zevon's ex-wife, Crystal Zevon. And we should just hear from her how this book came about, because it's very important, I think, to understanding where the book is coming from. So let's just listen to that.
Warren charged me with telling the whole story. He asked me shortly after he was diagnosed with terminal cancer to write the book. And we talked about it on and off over the last year of his life. You know, when he first asked me, we were still getting over the shock of the fact that he was going to die. So there's probably nothing I would have refused him. I didn't think very hard about what that meant. But as the year went on, he'd talk about things that it was important that he have included. And then a week before he died, he called me and said, "You're going to do this thing, right?" And I said, "Well, I guess so, Warren." And he said, "Well, you know, if you do it, you've got to tell the whole truth, even the awful, ugly parts, because that's the excitable boy who wrote them excitable songs." Those were his exact words. And I said, "You know, Warren, I don't think I know what the whole truth is." And he laughed. And he laughed in a way that I hadn't heard him laugh in a while, because he'd been pretty sick. And he said, "Oh, you'll find out." And I did.
there's some understatement, right? So, Richard, when did you first run into this book, or when did you first hear of or hear Warren Zevon?
Well, the fan part of it, as a teenager, I remember a mate of mine who played guitar in a band gave me Sentimental Hygiene, which was an album of his in 1987, and said, "You got to hear this." And it was interesting because REM were basically his backup band on that record. And immediately I heard this amazing voice, this erudite, sardonic character, and it was a great record. And I was living in Belfast at the time. He played live the following year, and after that, I just wanted to, every record of his I looked for keenly, as hard as they were to find, because he was not a, you know, not a household name by any means. Around about in the mid-90s, in what was for me the early age of the internet, there was a wonderful woman in Texas called Diane Berger who ran a fan website about Zevon, and we connected, and I would write the occasional fan column, and Diane would send me live tapes because she had this amazing collection of Zevon stuff. So that was a lovely friendship and a shared enthusiasm. Then, funnily enough, when I was in Los Angeles doing my book with Sean Penn in around 2002, I met Crystal Zevon, who was we had a mutual friend, that friend being the guy whose couch I would sleep on in Los Angeles. So we had dinner, and it was an interesting thing for me to meet her, obviously. And then, weirdly enough, I found myself at a party, which is pictured in the book, which was the engagement party for Zevon's daughter, Ariel, where the great man himself was there. Little did I know he knew his diagnosis. And it was the night he first took a drink, having not had one in 17 years. So, I mean that much of a little window into the story when I heard that Crystal was doing the book, and I was obviously... couldn't wait for it, and I certainly thought she did a bang-up job.
Yeah.
I would just like to say something before, and we are not going to spend the next however long talking about how much we love Warren Zevon, although three of us do. So I read this book about 10 years ago. It got really good reviews when it came out. It's very interesting that I was told when I was doing the prep for this episode that it was published by Dan Halpin at Echo in the States. No UK publisher would pick it up.
Interesting.
Because Zevon clearly was not perceived as sufficiently popular.
And yet, you'd have to say, it is a classic of the genre.
You'd not read it before,
no,
had you?
I was sort of vaguely aware of it. It was one of, you know, when people talk about great rock classics, this came up. And because I wasn't really, like most, I suppose most English fans, I knew that one song. And had a vague notion that he'd written with other people. But once you kind of uncover that, that's been the great thing. I mean, listening to a lot of his music over the last fortnight, and then the book itself is such a brave and kind of it's a remorseless tale of a very complicated, not altogether happy life.
Yeah.
But it's as good a portrait of the strange alchemy that produces not just music, but any kind of art. I mean, it reminded me in bits, you know, the letters of Van Gogh to his brother Theo, in terms of the portrait of that's very different because it's not, although Warren's voice is through the book, but you think, how does anyone actually survive at this level of intensity?
It's surely the least flattering authorized yes. biography ever published, isn't it?
Warts and all is too small a too mere a phrase to describe.
And we should say that I don't think this book is for everyone. I agree with you, John. I think as a portrait of, call it artistic temperament, it's hard to beat.
And also, I think as an example, but what Crystal Zevon has done as an oral history, as a sort of a work within a genre, what she's done, I think is beautifully constructed, in terms of, you know, laying one voice against another.
Yeah, just to come back, is it the harshest of all? Well, Martin Amis, in reviewing Peter Manso's Mailer, His Life and Times, called it the most exhaustive character assassination in the history of letters. And yet Mailer had blessed the book and was alive and well. So you do tend to go that way if you're going to go warts and all.
Do you think that Zevon would have liked the book, given how thin-skinned he was?
No, I think, like all of us, he was thinking that the stories of his dirty life and times wouldn't look so harsh on the page. But I think the man had a very well-turned sense of his own perversity, I think, and a sense of the secret badness of the world, if you like. We were chatting earlier about how even at the death he was crafting a career platform for himself out of his cancer. So I think he...
In no sense does he come out of it as likable. But what you come out of it is I came out of it with a strange sense of affection towards him and a much greater understanding. The case for the prosecution, and forgive me if I paraphrase you here, Matt, would be he's a self-indulgent, you know, middle talented American rock star who beat up his wife and had addiction problems. And you know, probably won't be remembered for much else other than that one song. So what's the big deal? Aren't we all just enabling by kind of trying to find a reasons to be sympathetic to this monstrous ego for all the problems that he had, his OCD and his, you know, why bother?
Is that a fair summation of your views?
And yet. The interesting thing I found was that I thought what she does is she obviously, no one suffered more at his hands than Crystal, I think, possibly his children.
Yeah, I'd go with them too, actually. Yeah.
But, you know, somehow they were there. It's very moving, the beginning of the book, which starts with his death, and then the final... no spoilers there, because obviously he's dead.
Yeah.
But I think it is. I did find it moving, and I just found it fascinating that you could, you know, to find sympathy for somebody who has behaved this badly and this self-indulgently and this irrationally is difficult.
But I'm just want to give you a couple of quotes here that seem to me they're both very short, but they're from different people who work with Zevon. And I think if you are, like, if you've worked in with artists or writers, or you are an artist or a writer, you will recognise both sides of this, whether you have chronic substance abuse problems or not. This is a guy called Duncan Aldrich, who was Zevon's driver and his roadie. He's talking about the end of their relationship in about 1996. He says this: driving around, no matter what Warren would look at or what would be happening, he'd just spew discomfort and hate, and it was driving me crazy to the point where at the end of the tour I said, this is not a criticism at all, but maybe this will help you. And I gave him the Book of the Tao, and I said goodbye. He ended up thinking I hated him or something, but I just didn't want to give an opinion on all the shit that was going down, and it was too hard to be around. I really didn't say anything. After that, he called by mistake once. I had a couple emails with him in the last year or so, but that was the end. I was with him for 12 years, and I know for a fact that was the longest relationship he ever had. You know, it's someone who found it incredibly difficult to feel secure with other people, be they in long-term relationships or working relationships. And then at the same time, there's this great quote from a guy called Noah Schneider, who was his sound engineer and was his engineer when they were doing this final album, The Wind, when he knew he was dying, which really sticks with me as a piece of self-knowledge which we could all apply. Noah Schneider says, one time when we just started recording The Wind, Warren could tell something was weird with me. He says, what's the deal with you today? I said, you've got cameras following you. There are movie stars stopping by. It just seems weird how a year ago it was just me and you doing a record together in your apartment. I wanted to say how all of a sudden people were jumping on the bandwagon and I was the guy who'd been there all along. Whatever, it wasn't really true, but it's how I felt at that moment. What he said was, oh, I see. It's an ego thing. Yeah. I'm stumbling all over myself. No, it's not about my ego. Warren goes, it's all right. It's okay if it's about your ego. Sometimes it's got to be about your ego. Just know that it is.
Yeah.
I use that all the time. And, you know, next time I go crazy at festival organiser for putting red M&Ms in my bowl, so it's ego, but I know it's ego. You know.
There's a nice thing towards the end of the book, that Michael Ironside wrote, which is, Warren was very proud of his life, which is a pretty extraordinary statement. I like that. There's that Nelson Mandela thing where he says, we're not afraid of our darkness. What we're afraid of is our lightness. Our job isn't to turn our bulb down to make the person next to us more comfortable. Our job is to turn our bulb up and give the next person permission to do the same. Warren did that, which seems to me kind of gets close to the truth. Is that although I'm not sure you could say that he was proud of his life. I think he seemed to me that he was racked with guilt about his kids, but he didn't. He was a survivor, although he died young. I mean, he survived what most people would have been snuffed out. As he said, the great quote is, "I got to have Jim Morrison's life a whole lot longer than he did."
Yeah.
I mean, as speaking of a fan of his, I mean, I think his status as a songwriter is copper bottomed.
Yeah.
There's a live recording of Bruce Springsteen playing his song My Ride's Here. It was played on the night that Zevon died. He said, I want to say goodbye to my friend Warren. He's one of the great American songwriters. And well, I happen to think that too, but I'll take Springsteen's opinion as the one that should stand. But I mean, having said all of that, I mean, I'd never felt the same about Zevon since this book. It's one of those things where he wasn't the man I thought he was.
Yeah.
It doesn't change the work one bit. But some of the behaviour just I find very tough to take. I just want to read this bit, a compilation of bits about Zevon's behaviour towards his now separated wife, Crystal, and their daughter, Ariel. And the first voice is Crystal's dad, Zevon's father-in-law. There were a number of occasions where I probably should have decked Warren, but Ariel's third birthday party was the closest I came. I was sitting in a lawn chair, and Warren and some other men were on their knees reading the assembly instructions for a swing set. Ariel hadn't seen her daddy since he'd moved out several months before, which had to be confusing for her since he'd worked at home and always been around since she was born. The minute he arrived, she left the kid she was playing with and never took her eyes off her daddy. He was down on his knees and she ran over with her arms open wide, wanting a hug. He saw her coming and put out his hand to stop her. It knocked her down, but he didn't even seem to notice. He ignored her. I will never forget that little girl standing up and brushing herself off, holding back her tears. I was out of my chair, livid. Quite a big lesson for a little girl. And then Crystal takes up the story the next day. At my request, Warren told Ariel he wouldn't be coming home anymore. And he went inside and started stuffing stuff into paper bags. The party was still going on, but he'd done his duty and he was clearing out. Warren said, Kim, his girlfriend Kim, and I would like to pick Ariel up tomorrow and have our own birthday celebration with her. I agreed, even though I knew he was drinking. They were supposed to pick her up for lunch the next day, and they were about 3 hours late. I still have this hauntingly beautiful black and white photo of Ariel, all dressed up for her daddy, sitting on this big boulder in front of our house, waiting. She stayed there for a full 2 hours, refusing to come inside. I find that very plaintive, you know, as the father of daughters.
Yeah.
And when you read the book, from a technical standpoint, as someone who's put these books together as a writer and an editor, what do you think the challenges were when putting this together?
Well, you've got to go to everybody. And this is, I mean, John alluded to this before. It's a good point. Memory is a real problem with these books. You're relying on your subjects. They've got to say it. You can't write it. Yeah. And moreover, I mean, I found this during my books. You ask people questions, and they know that you already know the answer. And you said, I know. I just need you to tell the story. I mean, when I did Sean Penn, one of the best people to talk to was Bono of U2. He said, I think I know what you want here. You didn't want information. You want me to tell your stories, have a shape to them, right? And I said, you've got it. and that's what Crystal did. She obviously had the advantage of the life, you know, she had those doors open. I mean, she said very charmingly, she didn't talk to Bob Dylan because she knew that Dylan wasn't going to say anything on tape that would be any use.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the book is brilliant about the era where most of its witnesses knew and did their best, which is the 70s.
I agree, yeah.
And that's a gilded cultural era. And in that place, you find out where the songs come from.
What I liked about it is, you know, because I kind of like, unlike you, Matt, Californian rock of the 1970s. I like the troubadour and all that. And there's great stories of, you know, Elton John turning up and playing the troubadour and all those. But I felt Zevon was a bit of a missing link for me between, you know, the Jackson brand. There's sort of you've got the Joni, James Taylor kind of end, and then you've got the Eagles, and then you've got Jackson Brown. And I sort of felt Zevon was kind of like,
well,
you know,
he has the blessing,
the Randy Newman of that scene.
He has the blessing and the curse of being the singer-songwriters.
Yeah. Exactly.
Singer-songwriter. Yeah.
But he was also, I mean, it's important. One of the things that comes out of the book, he went and hung out with Stravinsky when he was a kid. I mean, it's pretty, and he was classically trained. I mean, brilliant musician.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody said. Mm. He sort of genius level. I think part of the problem, you can sort of see without speculating, his OCD, he was on some kind of spectrum kind of... You know, he had difficulty with empathy, but he was a kind of a genius, and he read. He was the most.
We should say one of the things that
a lot of his mates were writers.
Yeah, that Richard was alluding to that he is a very. His friends were writers. He wrote songs with, as you were saying, Paul Muldoon, but he also wrote songs with Thomas McGuane and Carl Hyerson. He was friends with Hunter Thompson, Mitch Albom, Stephen King. You know, he preferred hanging out with writers, and he loved books and he loved reading. In fact, we have a short quote from near the end of his life, which for copyright reasons is under the fair use limit of 30 seconds. So, but we just have this from Zevon. So let's hear Warren's voice now.
I haven't been reading at all lately since my diagnosis. You know, my candy boy, Schopenhauer, said we love to buy books because we believe we're buying the time to read them. Isn't that grand?
Isn't that grand? It's also worth noting that when you read the book, you realise he's absolutely loaded on morphine and booze
whiskey and liquid morphine. Hell, who wouldn't?
So I'd just like to, everyone, there's one anecdote in this book that I think everyone who reads this book never forgets it. And I want to share it with people because it's so great. So when Zevon cleaned up, he was sober for 17 years. And they say that what happened to him from the early 80s, I think that's right, isn't it? Early 80s to the mid 90s, is that his OCD really took off, and that maybe the drugs and alcohol have been masking it, but it became a big problem for him. Right?
It's addictive behavior, isn't it?
Anyway, so this is somebody talking about one of the ways in which OCD manifested itself. This is Stuart. This is Stuart, a guy called Stuart Ross. Warren was buying only one shirt. Calvin Klein grey extra large t-shirts. He was buying them in every city. Every time there was a store that sold that exact t-shirt, he would go in and buy them. I figured that he was acting like a rock star and he wore them once and threw them away. No idea. Well, New Year's Day 1991, we're in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We have the night off and we're playing on January the 2nd. On January the 1st, he calls me. Is there anything to do? So we rented a car and drove to Amal. He loved to shop more than any heterosexual man alive. We go into a department store and he immediately starts buying grey Calvin Klein t-shirts. He's flipping through the rack and they're all the same size, all the same colour, but he flipped two or three, take that one, flip another, take that one. I don't know how he made his decisions, but some were lucky shirts and some were not lucky shirts. So he buys five or six of these. Later, we're walking to the car, and he notices another department store on the other side of the mall. He says, we haven't gone there yet. I said, why should we go there? He says, to get Calvin Klein t-shirts. I said, Warren, you just got six of them. He says, but not from that store. I said, what does it matter what store they come from? He said, it matters to me. I said, Warren, once you take them out of the package, you don't know what store they came from. And he said, and I'll never forget this, I don't take them out of the package. What do you mean you don't take them out of the package? He said, look, you collect fountain pens, right? I said, yeah. He said, well, I collect grey Calvin Klein t-shirts. I said, what are you talking about? Every one of my fountain pens is different. All your t-shirts are the same. And he said, the value is to the collector. I said, that's wrong. The value is to the marketplace and every one of your t-shirts is identical. Until this time, I thought he was just wearing them and throwing them away because he didn't want to do laundry. But no, he had more grey Calvin Klein t-shirts in their packages than Calvin Klein had. Years later, we're having lunch and he says, guess what? They don't make the same grey Calvin Klein t-shirts now. They're completely different. They're made in Malaysia now. He said, you laughed at me when I bought all those shirts. Now I have the only good grey Calvin Klein t-shirts in existence. Footnote. When Warren died, his t-shirts, still bagged, were distributed among family and friends who wear them still. Isn't that brilliant?
Sweet.
You know that great line at the end of Raging Bull, where the quotes from the gospel, I say, I do not know if he was a good man. All I know now is that yeah, I once was blind and now I see.
He was some kind of a man.
What does it matter? What does it matter what you say about people?
Anyone, anyway. Well, what a perfect note on which to end this fantastic discussion. I've enjoyed hugely. Thanks to our guest Richard T. Kelly and our producer Matt Hall. Our extensive archive, now 45 shows long, is available on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/backlistedpod, and we're on Twitter and Facebook, so come and say hello. And might we ask, if you've enjoyed the show, it'd be great if you could leave us 5-star only, please, reviews on iTunes. Thank you for listening. See you in a fortnight. Goodbye.
Enjoy every sandwich. You can choose to listen to Backlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted, where you also get bonus content of 2 episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks.